Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of October 5th, 2012.
I work in a paint store, and I make only like $12 an hour.
We had to go days without eating.
My water bill is $397 a month.
My bill would probably be like a simple bowl of beans.
Then we have the gas and electric. It goes up to $500 sometimes.
I had to learn how to cut my kids' hairs. Instead of paying $20 a month,
I just got my hours cut because my boss said I don't have a car. And she said I wasn't getting there on time to start my job.
Well, the struggle now is putting food on the table, still is.
There were several times that I was very discouraged and I thought I was never going to be able to make it.
That's what makes it tough.
It's stress.
Those were the toughest times.
I'm going to wonder how I'm going to be able to do that, but
we just have to do what we got to do.
A Marketplace Money special today on what it means to make decisions with your money when you don't have a whole lot of it. We're calling it Tough Choices, produced with our Wealth and Poverty Desk and KPBS in San Diego.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
For poor people in this country, every single penny counts. And good choices about how to spend those pennies can lead to a path out of poverty. Bad choices can send them spiraling downward. Today, we'll talk with a woman who's worked and saved enough to buy her own house, a family that's counting change picked up on the sidewalk, and a young man who will be the first in his family to go to college. We met them all in San Diego, where the poverty level of 15% mirrors the national average. You may imagine a city of boardwalks and beaches and historic hotels, which it is. But San Diego also has the City Heights neighborhood, a gritty, sun-baked district miles from the beach, where the Tinson Ricardos live. Being poor is messy. When we showed up at Halima Tinson's house for our scheduled interview, she was nowhere in sight. We caught up with her a couple of hours later in front of a neighborhood preschool.
Halima, hi, I'm Tess.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
She was in crisis mode, trying to get on top of a situation that could make or break her family finances.
So we were going to meet at your house earlier today. Tell us why we're here.
I'm here because I had to sign my twins up for child care for the Head Start.
And what kind of process was that like for you?
Crazy. Just running from Head Start to Head Start. It's a fair that you have to go to. So every time I went to the fair, I got there late. So this was the third time I came over here. And they finally took me.
Why were you late before?
Because of the bus. To get way over here, it takes time. I had to take the 7 to the 955, 955 to the 3 bus, and then that's how I got here.
So what does it mean to you to be able to get your kids into this program?
It means a lot because my husband will be able to go to work.
Tinson's husband looks after the youngest kids. The kinds of jobs he could get wouldn't pay enough to cover good child care, so it makes more financial sense to stay home. But free preschool means free time. Time to get some training, a job, hopefully more money.
It's stress, but I want my husband to go to school. Because I know once he finishes, I know I won't have to worry about the job anymore.
All right, so where are you going now?
I'm going home.
You're going home? All right. Well, let's go home then.
Can you guys stay here? I'm going to open the door from the back.
Okay.
Home is a big house nestled into a grassy hill on the outskirts of San Diego's City Heights neighborhood.
Oh, I feel better now.
So tell us about your home here. How long have you lived here?
I've lived here for about, I think it's been 2 years.
2 years.
It's a nice home. It's 4-bedroom, 3-bath.
What are you paying rent?
I have Section 8, so I pay like $400 or so in rent. My water bill is $397 a month. Then we have the gas and electric. It goes up to $500 sometimes.
It's manageable most months, she says. But in a poor family, one setback can sink you.
My job was paying me late on my checks.
Yeah, what happened there?
I wasn't getting them, and then I would get them, and then I wouldn't get them. You know, it would be sometimes that we would go without water for a whole week, maybe 2 weeks.
What did you do?
I had to go get water all the way up the hill. My husband would go get water back and forth to get water for them so they could take a bath. It was just a mess.
Tinson works part-time at a charter school. She is the lunch lady. She likes her job, but that water bill comes every month, even if her checks don't.
I only make now probably like $500 a month now.
$500 a month?
Yes.
So that's $6,000 a year.
Yep. I was making $1,200. I just got my hours cut because my boss said I don't have a car. And she said I wasn't getting to work, like getting there on time to start my job.
That's not a lot of money. How do you survive on that?
You make it stretch. You know, this economy is crazy. But you know what? I don't roll with the economy. I roll with the Lord.
But the fact is, Halima Tinson and her family have to live in this economy. And in this economy, they are poor. The official poverty line for a family of six is around $30,000 a year in income. Tinson and her husband scrape by far below that line.
Hello. It's a little warm out there,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a little warm.
Ricky Ricardo is Halima's husband, and he's walking into the rust-colored living room with a small bag of groceries on his arm. Ricardo handles a lot of the domestic duties, like shopping for food.
It's a science, because you have to figure out, we have a budget, how am I going to get six people fed off of $20? Got some chicken and a head of lettuce and some tortillas, and we make it work.
So that's $20 for dinner?
$20 a day.
And on a good day, we can stretch $30 a day if we cash in some aluminum cans.
Oh, for recycling.
Recycle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you win.
Small victories. But small defeats, too. Because for a family living in poverty, every money decision has a consequence, especially the less-than-sound decisions. And those bad moves, well, they can land you under the microscope.
Well, let me ask you, and I hope this isn't an insensitive question, but as you're talking about, you know, your lack of income, I can't help but look around and see...
Don't look like I can do it.
No, you have a very nice computer monitor. You have two
that's my son's huge computer.
Televisions. You have a very nice vanity behind us here.
Yeah.
This one I bought.
Right.
And then this one I bought.
They're cheap.
They're cheap?
They're cheap now, yeah.
They're cheap.
Meaning?
We only spent $50
for that
TV. And then on this TV, we spent
$125.
Yeah. And we have cable. Yeah.
You have cable?
Mm-hmm.
How can you afford cable?
We have to. With kids. We don't have no entertainment. We got to.
Yes.
We have to. They're here.
Four children, to be exact. Ricky Jr. is seven, Isaiah is five, and the twins, Adora and Jonah, are three.
So you brought money in the door. That's pretty impressive.
Ricky Jr.'s got 11 cents in his hand that he found on the sidewalk. He's only seven, but he already knows every penny counts, especially when the bills come due. Right now, it's that cable bill and the internet, too.
We have to have the internet because of the children.
Their
school curriculum requires them to be on the internet for reading and for doing
math
and stuff like that. So I'm given plasma to accommodate that.
How often are you doing that?
Twice a week now.
Twice a week?
And they know. You can ask them.
They know what?
They know that I'm giving it. They know I got it. And Ricky gave. Ricky's is a little different. His was an allergy study. And so Ricky got $100 for that. I mean, we just have to do what we got to do.
Ricky Jr., 7 years old, participating in a medical study to help pay the internet bill. Halima Tinson and Ricky Ricardo may be poor, but they've chosen to find riches in other parts of their lives.
The Lord says to live with prosperity. He wants you to have prosperity. I don't believe that I'm poor. I don't say that. I just live like the Lord wants me to live. Live with prosperity, and that's how I'm going to live.
I will say that we're challenged, but I would say that we're rich as far as the family is concerned, but that's what keeps us going.
Yeah. Well, thank you both.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for inviting us into your home.
No problem.
No problem.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
As we just heard from the Tinson-Ricardo family, being poor means making lots of tough choices. You buy groceries or you fill up the gas tank, assuming you have a car to begin with. Sometimes you make foolish choices, too. Sandeel Mulinathan is a professor of economics at Harvard. He studies the psychology of poverty and says the stress of being poor takes a psychological toll that can influence the way a person makes decisions with money. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of toll does poverty take on a person's ability to make good financial decisions?
So one of the things that I often do is I often have people appeal back to their own intuitions, put aside finances, and just think about yourself on a hard day. You've got a deadline coming up tomorrow, and you go to your daughter's softball game. You'd like to pay attention to the game, but you find your mind keeping going back to this deadline that you missed half the game. And to your daughter, you may have seemed like a bad parent because you didn't cheer when you were supposed to. Because part of your mind was not there, you were not fully yourself. And that's something we can all relate to. And I think money has a very similar and more powerful effect. When faced with financial scarcity, people's mind keeps going back to concerns such as, how will I make rent this month? And so as a result, when faced with financial scarcity, you're only partly there.
But doesn't that apply to everyone? I mean, if you're having to make a bunch of decisions in a row, I mean, that's always stressful, right? Why is it different for someone living in poverty?
The difference is in the magnitude and the intensity. You and I can be busy, and we take a vacation from work, and we say, look, I'm just taking a break.
Right.
You can't take a break from being poor. You can't say, I've had enough of worrying about money. I'm just going to be rich for a couple of weeks until I'm recovered. And so the intensity of it and the uniformity of it is what I think separates poverty from other forms of scarcity, such as being busy.
What about the idea of planning ahead? It seems like a lot of problems for poor families stem from not having a plan.
I think that is the central problem. And organizations talk about spending their lives firefighting, dealing with the next problem, but not having the bandwidth to look ahead to what's coming down the pipeline. And I think most of the poor end up in that trap of constantly dealing with the next big thing. And so I think that is the biggest decision-making error of poverty. In fact, we find that if you look at other decisions, decisions that have to do with managing money right now, the poor are significantly better than the rich. So, for example, if you go and stop people at a supermarket and ask them for their receipt and say, hey, how much did you just spend? Middle-class shoppers have no idea. The poor know what they just spent. In many, many ways, the poor are actually better decision makers for the problem they're focused on, which is fighting this fire, than the rich are.
I want to ask you about something that we saw while we were talking to a poor family that we've just heard from here on the show. Family of six, barely scraping by day to day, but they had two huge televisions. And, you know, I think this perhaps to a middle class family might seem like a good example of bad decision making. But is there something more going on here?
Again, let me appeal back to time. Think of yourself when you're very, very busy. Even in those busiest moments, you ended up spending an hour procrastinating when you knew full well you should be working. And I think one of the things about poverty is that we have very little room to fail. We all make mistakes. You and I make impulse purchases that are bad all the time. The difference is we have the slack to make them and not have it affect us. The other effect I think that I'd look to is happiness is a scarce commodity. And the things that you look to provide that happiness are also idiosyncratic and are also individualistic. And so if someone who's poor says, I may not have much money, but for me, what's really important is to have a good television so that my family can enjoy and sit and watch, we should just be a little careful in recognizing that just like we all have individual liberty to make the choices we want, that we not judge too much on that.
Sandeel Mullainathan is a professor of economics at Harvard. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tess.
In this part of the show, getting by. And getting by for some means finding little slices of joy in the midst of hard times. Something comedian Justin McKinney is quite familiar with. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
You know, a lot of the stuff that you joke about has to do with your upbringing. A poor kid in rural New Hampshire. I can't imagine that it was necessarily funny at the time.
No, not only was it not funny at the time, but actually looking back, it's not even funny now.
No.
like I could remember school picture day. Like that was the day when you kind of realized that you weren't one of the rich kids because the rich kids were like, up at the front of the line with, like, packet A, 15 10x12s, you know, 1,000 wallet size. And I'm way back at the end of the line. I have, like, packet Q, and it's, like, one picture, and it's, like, a Polaroid of the rich kid. So it's stuff like that that I would notice growing up.
Well, you know, this whole show today is about tough choices that poor people have to make when it comes to money. And we've heard a little from a family and a researcher who studies the psychology of poverty. Anything you can relate to here?
Well, I think it's all about choices. And everyone's situation is different. I mean, I like to say that I'm not white trash. I'm like a step above that. I'm more like white clutter. And
can I just tell you, I feel kind of uncomfortable laughing.
No. Don't be uncomfortable. When you don't laugh, that's even more uncomfortable. Okay. At least if I get laughter out of it, it actually feels good. But no, it's like I will go to a restaurant, and a lot of people do this. You can't just pick whatever you want without looking at the prices. So I would go to a restaurant and not even look at the entree list. I would go right to the prices. You know, the waitress would be like, what are you in the mood for tonight? And I'd go, I guess the additional topping, I guess, is what I'm is what I'm in the mood for. And then as a dad, I'm always making these choices. You know, my wife's like, oh, my boy who's 5 now wanted to take karate and swimming lessons. I'm like, well, we can't do both. I say swimming lessons. And she's like, well, I think karate. I go, what's better odds? That he's going to end up being around water or he's going to get jumped by a pack of pre-Kers, right? I think swimming. So we ended up going with the swimming lessons, and I got a really good deal. I signed him up in an online course.
An online swimming course?
Online swimming course, yes.
Excellent.
And look, and I got to tell you right now, I'm feeling kind of guilty because my 4-year-old, he's now 5, but when he was 4, he heard the ice cream truck coming for the first time ever. And he's like, Daddy, what's that? I'm like, that's a tornado warning. Get in the house.
What is it about poverty, do you think, that seems to breed comedians? I mean, so many of your fellow funny men and women grew up poor like you.
When my brothers and I get together, we will sit and laugh about things that we had growing up. You know, I mean, I remember not having a hair dryer, and we would literally dry our hair over the oven. And what's a blow dryer? 12 bucks? I don't know. And we just look at that as funny. I mean, whether it was the haircuts we got, you know, our hair got cut the whole time by our parents. So I think it was just, it's just easier to laugh at things, you know. And I think that's where it kind of comes from.
And we'll be back with more from comedian Justin McKinney later in the show. If you're living on the edge of poverty, a car may not seem like the best financial choice. You're paying for insurance, gas, maintenance, tickets. But as we heard earlier, not having a car can also be a financial burden. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
Vanessa Pacheco can't take a San Diego bus the 4 miles to her job.
I am a single mother. I'm working 40 hours a week. I'm a manager in food service.
She works at a smoothie joint.
I work really early in the morning.
Smoothies are a popular breakfast in sunny, health-conscious San Diego, and Pacheco has to be at work at 5 a.m. to open the store. But the bus doesn't start running until almost 6. And right now, Vanessa Pacheco doesn't have a car.
I got in a car accident. Now there's a cat in the middle of the road, and as soon as I got there, I realized the kids were in the car, and they were going to freak out that I killed a cat, and I guess I thought I could swerve. And
Pacheco didn't swerve fast enough, hit 2 cars, and totaled hers. Nobody was injured, good thing, because she doesn't have health insurance. But Pacheco did have car insurance, just liability to save money.
If I would have had full coverage, I could have at least got $1,000, and that could have been a nice payment on a car, but... You know, it's the things they don't tell you when you sign up for insurance.
Especially if we're thinking about getting cars, we got to think about insurance. Yeah. How much you guys think insurance runs these days?
Veronica Villarreal helps teach a financial literacy class to parents who, just like Vanessa Pacheco, find themselves without reliable transportation. The United Way is working with Villarreal's agency to launch a national program called Ways to Work in San Diego. It helps working-class parents with bad credit get car loans at low interest rates. Villarreal shares budgeting tips and passes out information about state programs that give poor residents money for car repairs.
You're able to go to the Bureau of Automotive Repair, and they will help you to have those repairs fixed so that your car can pass the smog.
Something as small as not passing a smog check can have a domino effect. You can't register your vehicle. You get tickets. If the tickets go unpaid, your car can be towed. A student I met in this financial literacy class knows something about trying to get a car out of impound.
You basically just left your car because it was too expensive.
I couldn't pay for it, and I'm pretty sure it's racking up some money somewhere.
When you're poor, like Annabelle Kinata, and your car gets towed, the choice is pay for that or pay your rent.
Those are really tough decisions.
Shayna Gross is a vice president with San Diego's United Way. She recognizes that if you're living on the edge of poverty, owning a car can be a huge financial responsibility. But after spending months interviewing poor and working class people, she's convinced a car does more good than harm to their bottom line. And Gross says the Ways to Work program stresses financial literacy. That's why it's successful.
41% of their clients have increased their take-home pay. 82% of the participants were able to move off of public benefits, public welfare programs.
But she says it was her interviews with the newly homeless at a safe parking lot run by a local nonprofit called Dreams for Change that made her understand just how essential a car can be.
That's all we have. There is no one who's gonna say, I'll give you a ride, I'll take your kids to school, I'll take you, I'll pick you up and take you. There is no support, so I need my car.
Yolanda Cortez is a single mom. She has two sons. She was laid off from her office assistant job with the San Diego School District more than a year ago, but she paid off her car when times were good. Now she uses it to get to and from cosmetology school. Cortez is confident she'll find a job after graduation.
And I can't wait. I want the best for my kids. Hopefully with this experience I create some very, very well-trained young men. They'll have a legend and a story to tell.
Tonight, her 11 and 8-year-old son will go to sleep in the front seats of her Acura, and Yolanda will curl up in the back in that safe parking lot in southeast San Diego. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Sometimes they want to be there with me too in the back, and what do you do about that? When they just want to be right next to mommy.
Poverty is a given in America, but why are there so many poor people here? And how do they get out of poverty? Simple questions, not so simple answers. We have dueling takes now from two experts on poverty in America. First up, Charles Murray of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
It's kind of a mystery that so many people who are physically able to work are still below the poverty line. The poverty line for a couple is $15,130, which you can make at a minimum wage job if you work full time. So personal responsibility, yeah, that has a role insofar as in a good job market, to be poor, if you are physically able, is a choice. Right now, the government subsidizes bad decisions. It masks the consequences of doing things at a young age that will blight the rest of your life. Here are the rules for not being in poverty. Finish high school. If you're a woman, don't have a baby if you don't have a husband. Get into the labor force and stay there. Used to be, if you were a male in this country, you worked or you looked for work. It was just socially unacceptable not to. That's changed. And that betokens a fundamental change in some basic American values. It has been taken as the new American creed, thou shalt not judge. And in the process of refusing to be judgmental, those in the upper middle class go merrily along in their lives, behaving by codes of behavior that work real well, but they will not say to anybody else, this is a good way to live your life, it's the right way to live your life. If you're a middle class kid, if you're an upper middle class kid, mom and dad will rescue you. Does that mean that we should not hold the poor to the same standards? I'd say that, come on, why is it that middle class and upper middle class kids have such much higher rates of getting into the labor market, such much lower rates of having babies without husbands? And the answer to that is that they have been told this is the way you're supposed to live your life. Seems to me that what we need to do is a lot better job of getting the message across to kids from disadvantaged backgrounds. You know what? You don't have to be poor, but you do have to make the following decisions.
Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute. Now to Melissa Boteic of the Liberal Center for American Progress on why people are poor and how they can move into the middle class.
Widening income inequality over the past 40 years has really meant that a lot of low-wage working families have been left out of the gains of economic growth. Another issue is that our societal institutions have not kept up with changes in the American family. So, for example, today, women are breadwinners or co-breadwinners in two-thirds of American families, but we don't have basic protections such as paid sick leave to care for a sick kid or access to affordable quality childcare, which is a barrier to work for a lot of people. the best ticket out of poverty is a good job. For working age adults, people have a responsibility to be either looking for work or striving to support themselves. And then in turn, we have a responsibility to ensure that there are those opportunities to do that and that we're removing barriers to work. In the cases where people are children or seniors or people with a disability that would not allow them to work, we need to examine our system of work and income supports to make sure that everybody in our society can live with a modicum of dignity. I think the role of the government is to provide pathways to opportunity. There are people who are working full-time year-round who are still in poverty. And so I think it's really both and. It's not either personal responsibility or the government's job. It's both. One of the most important things to know is that, you know, poor people's needs and ambitions and desires are not different than those of the middle class. They want to have a secure home for their kids. They want their kids to get a first-class quality education. They want a job that pays living wages so that they can support their family. They're willing to work hard. They're willing to try and put in that personal responsibility. And we need to meet them halfway.
Melissa Boteic of the Center for American Progress. Could you make it on less than $2,000 a month? Try out our poverty simulator at marketplace.org. Barely scraping by is one thing. Homelessness is another. Up to 3.5 million people will experience homelessness this year in America, and ending up in a shelter may seem like a last resort. But for some, it's a new beginning.
Hi, Alicia. Tess.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. How are you today?
Alicia Ortiz is 44. She's got four kids. 12 years ago, she was homeless and living in a shelter. Not anymore.
Alicia, why don't you tell us about your new home here? How long have you been here?
It's been, it's going to be 3 months. I move in here on June, I think.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Ortiz has just become a homeowner for the first time in her life. A community housing program matched her down payment, but saving up still was not easy.
I work in a paint store and I make only like $12 an hour.
Given that you were making $12 an hour, how were you able to afford this?
I guess it is a miracle. It was very hard for me to save up money. I was saving $100 a month. 12 years ago, my ex-husband and I split up, and I was moved out for domestic violence, and I was moving to a shelter in Escondido. Back then, I didn't have my immigration papers. I didn't know how to drive. I didn't have a car. Of course, I didn't have a job.
How did you live without a car, without a job?
So I learned how to drive. I filed for a divorce. I got my immigration papers through the program for women that have been in domestic violence. So I was able to get my permit for the first 5 years. And after 5 years, I had to show them that I was going to be able to support myself without getting assistance. So I did it. And little by little, you know, I got on my feet.
Talk us through how you did that. What's the secret?
I just cut on certain things. Like, you know, I had to learn how to cut my kids' hairs. Instead of paying $20 a month, we stopped going out to eat. Instead of going out to eat, I would buy groceries and cook at home. Another thing that I learned is to always look for the deals. Discount rack in the stores. And I get like shampoos, I get soap, toothpaste, bread, always on sale.
What are some of the tough choices that you look back on that you had to make?
There was a times when my kids were very young. I was working the graveyard, which I had to be at work at 1 in the morning, and I didn't get off until 7. I went home on my lunch break, pick up my kids, take them to school, and go back to work. Those were the toughest times.
From homeless to homeowner in 12 years.
And I really like it a lot because the granite.
It's a condo in the northern part of San Diego, 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, and it's hers.
Since I was a little girl, I always wanted to have a chimney for Christmas and, you know, with a Christmas tree and, like, on TV.
Next step, saving up for a full-size fridge.
So since I don't have money right now and I haven't been able to save up enough for a bigger one, I just bought a little one for the meantime.
Ortiz took advantage of every financial literacy program offered when she lived in the shelter. It helped her change the way she thought about money. With every decision Ortiz made, she asked herself, does this get me closer to my goal?
What was it like for you thinking about the future at a time when things were really tough. Was that discouraging at all to wonder when that was going to happen for you finally?
Yes. To be honest with you, there were several times that I was very discouraged and I thought I was never going to be able to make it. Because as being a single mom, you know, and making so little money, I just thought it was not a possibility for me. But when I joined the program and they told me, oh, no, you can do it. You just got to learn how to manage your money. And that's how I was able to do it.
How did you get yourself through those times when you just didn't think it was going to happen?
I just had to push through.
You make that sound easy.
No, it was not easy.
How do you communicate that to your kids?
You know, we made, what's it called, like collage?
Collage, yeah.
We made a collage, and each of us put a section. I asked them, what are your dreams? What would you like to be? And each of us put our dreams. So it helped us to get through it. And there was times when, you know, they wanted something. I said, you know what, I'm sorry, we can't afford it right now. We have a goal.
So you have a 14-year-old son. What was his dream that he put on the collage?
He wanted to do well in school. He wanted to have a career. He wanted to become a policeman. But now he changed his dream. Now he wants to have his own business. He doesn't want to work for anybody. He wants to have his own business.
And your 21-year-old?
She wanted a home. And now I feel like, you know, this is home.
That's part of the American dream.
It is.
To go from having nothing to having a little piece of something. Alicia Ortiz still lives on the edge of poverty, but she says she doesn't feel poor at all. In this segment, Crossing Paths, stories of how people on other rungs of the ladder mix with poor people. The income gap between the top and bottom 20% of earners in San Diego is stark. Those at the top make half of all the income in the county. Those at the bottom make just 3%. Reporter Tom Fudge of KPBS takes a look now at that divide and how San Diego's rich and poor view each other.
Good afternoon, this is Bob Shulman.
Bob Shulman, Tom Fudge.
It seems like you found the right place. Now, here's what you're going to do.
There's more than one house on the gated property of Bob Shulman, who lives in Rancho Santa Fe, one of the richest communities in the U.S. His main house is a mansion of stone floors, plush furnishings, and soaring windows. But Shulman makes no apologies. He says he earned it.
The people that I know, and I know many businessmen, they were not handed things. They did build this. I built this company. I profited. My investors profited.
Shulman is the founder of Cognex Corporation, which makes small computers that control manufacturing tools. He says he lived the American dream. His dad ran a small retail store in a rundown part of Boston, and he says if anything is hampering social mobility in the U.S., it's government regulations that make entrepreneurship difficult. Asked about the widening gap between the rich and the poor, he's not sure he accepts the premise of the question.
I think the definition of poor today is more like they don't have a 50-inch flat-screen TV. How can you be poor, Tom? How can you say somebody's poor if they have a cell phone?
Kathleen Krantz has a cell phone. She also lives in her car. Krantz is 64. She gravitated to San Diego from Northern California, along with two college-aged children. Her daughter is going to community college, and she's also homeless.
Daughter is living in her car. We park next to one another every night, watch over each other.
Krantz says she grew up poor near the Oregon border, where her stepfather sorted potatoes and drew unemployment. When asked how she came to be homeless, Krantz tells of many mishaps, including being diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She says her divorce, after 20 years of marriage, left her with little for retirement.
Because I was a wife and didn't work and didn't build my Social Security because I thought that I would be married still, I ended up with a very mere $288 in Social Security benefits.
We'll hear from Krantz again, but first, let's go back to Rancho Santa Fe, where Marianne McDonald lives in a dark, sprawling house that's showing its age. Unlike Shulman, McDonald inherited her wealth from her father, a co-founder of Zenith Corporation.
I think there's an obscenity in the world's concentration of wealth,
And I'd love to do my bit towards it, but it's so very hard for an individual to figure that.
At age 75, McDonald still teaches classics at UC San Diego. She says Aristotle distrusted the poor and the rich. He said the first would do anything to better themselves, and the latter fell victim to power madness. But if a large middle class is the ideal, San Diegan Hafsa Mohammed doesn't see that happening in America's bifurcated economy. The daughter of Somalian refugees, Mohammed comes from a low-income family in the central city. Her mother had to work two jobs to support six children after her husband was deported for immigration fraud. Thanks to student loans, Hafsa is attending San Diego State. She says American society is stacked against social mobility.
Right now, there's just none of that. There's people looking down and there's people looking up, and there's tons of barriers.
Everyone in this country has opportunity.
Again, Bob Shillman.
What's important is to rise above the thought that you are doomed to poverty.
That second part is something people actually agree on. Despite her low-income childhood, Mohammed says she will get her Ph.D. Krantz says her son and her daughter will have a college education and they will do better than she has done.
I wanted them to set their star up there and grab for it wherever it is.
Call it the American dream, but living without it is living without hope. And that's something nobody wants. In San Diego, I'm Tom Fudge for Marketplace.
Some families in San Diego know what it means to live at each end of the income divide. Clifford Fleischbein and Dee Dee Varner went from being in the 1% to living just above the poverty line. He's an independent IT consultant, and over the past decade, his clients outsourced most of his work overseas. Now his family of five is living on the edge, and every money decision comes with the risk of falling below the line. But in the family's home, you can still see vestiges of a formerly comfortable life. Like an organ that son Ryland plunks away at in a side room.
Which one are you going to play? Can you tell us the name and who wrote it?
Stuttgart.
Basically, we went from living at about $250,000 a year to just now I'm barely making $36,000, and that's a stretch and a squeak.
Once you lost the big client, that was the beginning of 2002. We took money out of savings, because we thought that things would get better, but then no work really filled in.
Collectively, you take just a little bit at a time, think, well, next month will be a better month. And so you take a little bit more, and before you know it, oh my gosh, I got $80,000 in credit cards.
When we were cutting back, it was little stuff here and there. So we didn't go places, we didn't renew our zoo passes. The big things like insurance, we had to stop doing.
While we've had good health and stuff, you don't know what's promised tomorrow. You don't know if you're going to have a car accident, some jerk's going to run into you and throw you in a situation where, gosh, you'd rather be dead than alive, because what it's going to cost you, it's only going to take one catastrophic event, and we won't be able to keep up with it.
You know, people say, so is Kyle driving yet? He's 17. And I'm like, absolutely not. If he were to have an accident, which statistics indicate he's likely to have, then it would ruin us.
The children have learned how to live comfortably with little means. If you see how some of their friends get to live, they go more places, they do more things, they all have cell phones. See, our family, we don't have cell phones.
I know a lot of the kids at my school, they all go to Disneyland together a lot, and they're always like, oh, Heidi, come on, come with us. And I'm like, have fun, you guys, take some pictures, let me know what it's like, but I can't go.
So this is where they practice harps.
Surely someone's going to hear this and they're going to say, well, how could this family who's so poor or struggling have harps, because they're not inexpensive? And the answer is, certainly we don't have any money to pay for college, but Heidi can go play for a wedding, play for 90 minutes, earn $250. Would I want to ask her to go become a waitress somewhere for minimum wage when she could do that?
When I went to apply for food stamps Oh my gosh, my eyes are getting crossed after, you know, 10 pages, and you have to submit all these different forms, and if you don't have this kind of form, you got to get that kind of form, and because he's self-employed, we're in a different category, and so I just canceled the interview because I was afraid they were going to, you know, accuse me of fraud.
It's scary, but you know, you can't allow yourself to be consumed with fear because it'll disable you. You have to try to get up each morning, really put yourself together, like, I got some place to go. You've got to try to go through doors and try to find opportunity. And sometimes you get a little bit, and the rest of the time you got to go home and just sit down with your wife and say, what do we have for vegetables and noodles tonight? You know, we don't have meat and stuff around here because we can't afford that kind of good stuff.
We have tried very hard not to feel victimized. It's an easier way to go because there hasn't been a real clear way out. But nonetheless, you know, if you want to be normal, you can't be a victim.
It's just, you can't feel better by envying someone else's prosperity. I think the real joy of life is learning how to be joyful with what you've got.
Comedian Justin McKinney grew up poor, but he has managed to climb into the middle class. In his latest comedy special, A Middle Class Hole, he talks about making that transition, and he tells us why it's failed to solve all his problems.
It's been a challenge. I mean, look, I am, even now, I mean, I'm very happy where I'm at, but I'm still even making, I mean, people are like, are you starting to save money for your kids' college? And I'm like, college? I'm trying to put them through daycare right now. Daycare is like college. It's $25,000 a year for my two kids in daycare. That's not even to live on campus. They have to come home every night. So, but it's been, you know, my wife and I got married in December in Massachusetts. And people are like, you got married in the winter in December in Massachusetts? What are you thinking? I'm like, I'm thinking it's cheaper.
It's cheap, yeah.
I mean, I know it was risky being an outdoor wedding. So it's just stuff like that, constantly making decisions. It is tough, and I'm trying to think of how I'm getting cab fare to get back to my hotel when I get out of this interview.
How about we subsidize that for you?
No, I'm kidding.
Justin McKinney's taping a new special on October 20th called Pain and Ice Cream in Manchester, New Hampshire. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
When it comes to economic mobility, climbing the ladder is tough for someone born at the bottom. Only 4% of poor kids will ever make it to the top 20% of earners. And even modest gains, climbing one rung into the middle class, can seem impossible to a kid born into poverty. A kid like Bertin Solis, he's 18 now, but up until this year, he was a child living deep in poverty.
I have my blankets ready. I have shirts.
Bertin lives in a government-subsidized apartment in the City Heights neighborhood of San Diego with his mom, Edith, his dad, and three siblings. The day of our visit, he was packing up his room after making one of the most important decisions of his life. You're on your way to school?
Yeah, I'll be attending UC Santa Barbara.
Well, congratulations. Are you looking forward to that?
Thank you. Yes, I am. Yeah.
What do you think you want to do when you grow up?
I wanted to go into law enforcement. Yeah.
Have you seen like shows on TV? Or?
Yeah, like CSI.
Yeah. What's the part about it that you really like?
I myself like helping other people, so that would be a way that for sure I'll be able to help others.
Let me ask your mom, how are you feeling about your son going away to college?
Oh, pues para mí es algo muy bueno.
Yeah, she said that she's really proud of me and that like she's really happy that I'm going to college, that she's glad that I came to this level since I will be the first one to go to college.
First one in your family to go to college?
Yeah, first one in my family.
Bertin wants to help people, and right now he does that by helping his parents. To earn extra income, he gets up at the crack of dawn on weekends to go on the job with his dad, a landscaper. I wonder if you're worried at all about how your family is going to do without you home as you leave for college. What does that mean to them?
Well, that's actually a worry for me right now, too, because landscaping is really hard. Sometimes we get out like at 6 in the afternoon, and that's with my help. Now, I can't imagine how it would be for my father to do the whole thing on his own.
Well, let me ask your mom the same question. How concerned is she to be losing you?
Bueno, yo pienso que nos va a
afectar. He's in that it's going to affect them a lot because I'm basically the one that helps them out with almost everything here. And specifically to my dad, too, because he's kind of weak with the illnesses right now. And as far with my parents, both of them, like, I won't be able to, you know how I'm translating now. I'm going to wonder how I'm going to be able to do that. But hopefully my little sister, she'll be able to help them out with translating at least.
So going to college has its own trade-offs. Solis is getting a full ride to a state school here in California, courtesy of the Gates Foundation, all the way up through a PhD, should he choose to go that far with his studies. The lifetime earnings of a college graduate are 84% higher than a high school graduate.
That's actually one of my motivations, that by going to college, I'll be able to come back and help them. Once I'm able to help them, I can have a good financial situation where I can support for my future family, too, so that they won't have to go through what we have gone through.
And they've been through a lot. Bertin was born in Los Angeles, but his parents raised him in Mexico. They moved back to San Diego when he was 7.
In Mexico, things were way tougher than they are here. We had to go days without eating. My meal would probably be like a simple bowl of beans. That's all I would have. Coming here to the United States, we still struggle financially, but it's better.
What is the struggle like now?
Well, the struggle now is putting food on the table. It still is. That's pretty much a struggle that is for my dad right now, since he's the only one working. He needs to come up with money to pay the rent, to buy food, to buy clothes for us. So that's what makes it tough.
Tougher still, Bertin's parents are in the country illegally. They wanted more for their kids, opportunity, economic mobility. And Bertin decided early on that he would not waste that opportunity. He joined an after-school program called Reality Changers, a local nonprofit that helps build first-generation college students. The group provided tutors when Bertin struggled in math. They prepped him for the SATs, and they helped him write scholarship essays when he was applying for schools. He graduated with a 4.1 GPA.
So what did that mean for your social life in high school?
It was still pretty good. I was part of the French club. I was part of a wrestling team. I was the captain, actually. I was also part of cross country, track and field. So it was. I still had a good social life there. And
how did you do all that and get a 4.1?
You never slept,
I assume.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Some days I would go without sleeping, but it paid off.
Bertin is probably not done with all-nighters for good, but life is about to change for him. No more Saturdays trimming palm trees or mowing lawns. Not that he regrets helping out.
Doing that job actually helps me realize that why I needed to go to college, because I thought about it. You could either work with your mind or with your back. That's how I saw it. Gave me an effect onto why I needed to keep working hard in school.
Many poor children don't see it that way, though, because all they see is poverty, not opportunity. That's when poor children become poor adults. I asked Solis whether it's up to kids to find their own way to a better life.
Yeah, it is up to the kids, but also the people that you're surrounded will make you who you are. So, like, if you're surrounded by kids that have different mindset than you do, then it's going to be harder for you to go through the road that you want to go through. But also, I feel that you need a lot of support from your parents, too, because if you don't have no one that believes in you, then you can't really believe in yourself.
Back upstairs, Solis and his mom are sorting out plans for the day he leaves, for the day he sets off on the road to his financial future. And he asks her if she'll miss him.
Mucho.
And to see photos of all the families featured today, go to marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Our wealth and poverty special, Tough Choices, was produced by Jolie Podokas. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Special thanks this week to our partner KPBS in San Diego. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. This is APM.